Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with a reading and analysis of a speculative manuscript authored by Kevin Coogan, the author of the landmark text about Francis Parker Yockey entitled Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, that published in softcover by Autono Media, copyright 1999. This manuscript is entitled Domestic Gladio, and again was authored by Kevin Coogan. It is speculative in nature, and we're going to resume where we left off on the previous side of the tape. This is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of December 19, 1999.
Both Daniel Burroughs and John Patler, the two Rockwell followers who later founded the American National Party, visited New Orleans for a Nazi-backed anti-civil rights demonstration in May of 1961. Rockwell sent Burroughs, Patler, and other Nazis in a hate bus, unquote, to the Big Easy after an obscure New Orleans-based English fascist named Michael Slatter visited Rockwell's Virginia headquarters in March of 1961. Slatter raised the money for the hate bus. Rockwell had a friend in Maurice Brooks Gatlin, who was reported to have been the Nazis' attorney in the region. Note again that Gatlin was an investigator and worked for Guy Bannister. Gatlin was reportedly involved with channeling CIA funds to the Secret Army Organization, or OAS, the French far-right group that tried to assassinate French President Charles de Gaulle. One line of investigation into the Kennedy assassination is focused on a top OAS operative named Jean-René Souettre, who was reported to have been passing through Dallas on the day Kennedy was assassinated. By the way, there's a good account of the Souettre connection in the landmark text, The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, hardcover and softcover editions, published by Carroll and Graff Publishers, copyright 1992. And what we're going to look at next, bearing in mind what we've looked at so far, Rockwell's connection to Bannister, Bannister's connections to the Minutemen, the Bannister Detective Agency had many connections to the intelligence community, to Wackel, to the paramilitary right, to the Minutemen, to the racist right, through its anti-civil rights activities, was involved in the anti-Castro Cuban effort, and also almost certainly in the Kennedy assassination. And bear in mind Kevin's hypothesis about a domestic gladio, and in particular the pivotal 1958 National Security Council directive. Skipping ahead in Kevin Coogan's document, he discusses Reinhard Gehlen spy networks in the United States. Reinhard Gehlen, recall, well-known to veteran listeners, was the Nazi intelligence chief for the Eastern Front. He jumped with his entire organization, described by former military intelligence Colonel William Corson, as nothing but a front for Odessa Nazis, unquote. Gehlen jumped to the U.S. intelligence apparatus with his entire organization and became, in effect, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately the BND, the German intelligence service, when the Federal Republic was incorporated, while continuing to supply the U.S. and NATO with the vast bulk of their intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and the Gehlen Org retained all of its Nazi character. In addition to its activities abroad, the Gehlen Organization had active networks in the United States. And we're going to see just how that fits into this puzzle in a second. This section of Kevin's paper is entitled, The Gehlen Org in America, and it reads as follows. Now, the DNZ, recall, is the Deutsche National Zeitung und Soldatenzeitung, originally begun as part of the Gladio program with assistance from U.S. intelligence, and it was in this paper that the allegation about Oswald shooting at Walker was first reported on November 29th of 1963, despite the fact that, according to the official record, it was first disclosed to the light of day by Marina in an interview with the FBI on December 3rd. And its editor, Gerhard Frey, was the leading financial backer of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the Russian fascist, and Gerhard Frey's a political party, the DVU, the Deutsche Volksunion, has scored considerable election successes in parts of the former East Germany. Continuing. And this again is Kevin's, this section of Kevin's paper is entitled The Gehlen Org in America. But how did the DNZ get its story in the first place? That's the story of Oswald shooting at Walker. And for that matter, what really was the DNZ? Perhaps the answer to that question lies in the paper's sponsors, which included the German press office, which was linked to German intelligence. In 1951, that could only mean the Gehlen Org, the spy service organized by the former head of German military intelligence for the Russian front, Reinhard Gehlen. In 1945, Galen was brought to the United States and his espionage network was put on Uncle Sam's payroll. Once Germany regained its sovereignty in 1955, the Galen Org was rebaptized as the Bundesnachrichtendienst, or BND, or the Federal Intelligence Service, West Germany's CIA. For its part, the Federal Press Department was under the direct control of Dr. Hans Globke, Adenauer's Secretary of State and Galen's closest collaborator inside the German government. In the early 1950s, Globke created a special chancellery fund to finance specific missions for Galen, who answered to Globke. It also turned out that Galen created a number of espionage cells inside the United States that were unknown to the FBI until after the Kennedy assassination. According to E.H. Cookridge, the British biographer of Galen, by the way, that biography is called Galen, Spy of the Century, in 1963, a U.S. Senate investigation into the lobbying efforts of the Julius Klein Public Relations Company on behalf of Germany led to, quote, the Association of American Citizens of German Origin, which was receiving large subsidies from an unspecified federal German government department, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, it was later established. This foreign subsidy amounted to the handsome sum of $280,000 in 1964 and was increased in later years. At first, the FBI suspected that the firm and the association were clandestine East German fronts, but then they discovered that they were run and financed by the Secret Service of a friendly NATO country. By the way, in For the Record segment 158, we dealt with the Julius Klein Public Relations firm, its relations, its relationship with West German heavy industry, and also to Senator Thomas Dodd, and also through those to the Bormann Organization. That again, For the Record segment 158. Continuing, Cookridge then reports, again quoting the Cookridge text, the explanation Galen willingly gave to J. Edgar Hoover was that these organizations were engaged in, quote, supervising German businessmen, tourists, and particularly students and officers of the Bundeswehr sent to America for studies or specialized military and Air Force training, unquote. The FBI happily closed its file on the subject. Not so satisfactory at first were the explanations of Galen's connections with the large organizations of Ukrainians, Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians, and other East European immigrants in the United States, which received finance and advice from three registered, unquote, BND agents, Roman Henlinger, alias Dr. Grau, Victor Solomon, and Alexander Weber. That's Weber, W-I-E-B-E-R. The American authorities were, however, pacified when they were told that from these organizations, the men were being recruited to be infiltrated into the communist orbit. Whatever Galen's global activities, he never entirely abandoned the time-honored system of sending his V-men across the eastern frontiers, unquote. The implications of Cookridge's report are staggering. First, it means that the CIA allowed and hid Galen's operations from the FBI, which is in charge of domestic intelligence. This last sentence again, because it's important. The implications of Cookridge's report are staggering. First, it means that the CIA allowed and hid Galen's operations from the FBI, which is in charge of domestic intelligence. Second, Galen had a considerable network inside America in order to monitor select German visitors, as well as to recruit Eastern European exiles. Many Eastern European anti-communists were linked to a series of governments in exile, unquote, supported by the CIA through umbrella organizations like the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the European wing of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, or APACL. These groups were part of the same apparatus that included Bannister's Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. The CIA may have encouraged Galen's efforts because many of the East European exile groups had their origin in the German-backed anti-Comintern groups established during the 1930s and 1940s. The next section is entitled The Galen Org and the American Right. The Galen Org even managed to establish a lobbying base in Washington, D.C. to maintain direct contact with right-wingers in both Congress and the military. The operation was ostensibly centered around Dr. Walter Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R, a parliamentarian who headed the BHE, or Union of Ex-Palais and Victim of Injustice bloc in the Bavarian Diet. The BHE consisted of Germans forced to flee either from East Germany or from German-speaking regions like Bohemia. By the way, Becker and his operation discussed in RFA programs 11 and 37. Continuing. Becker, a member of both the Nazi Party and the SA, spent the 1930s working for Konrad Henlein's Nazi-backed party in the Sudetenland. During the war, he worked for the propaganda ministry and Wehrmacht as a war correspondent. After the war, he made his career as a leading spokesman for the ultra-right wing of the millions of refugees who fled from the Sudetenland and Eastern Europe. He edited a paper called Sudetendeutsche, I'm not even going to attempt this, the Sudeten German National Expelle Association in English. In the early 1950s, Becker began coming to Washington to meet with far-right politicians like Joseph McCarthy. In 1955, Becker established a Washington office to represent the Expelle. It was headed by Richard Sallet, S-A-L-L-E-T, a top propaganda and foreign ministry expert on American affairs who had served as an attaché in the German embassy in Washington from 1934 to 1937. Sallet worked on American affairs for Berlin all during the war. He also had extensive connections inside the elite of the American far right that included the economist Lawrence Dennis and Congressman Hamilton Fish. In the 1930s, Sallet was the man who introduced American visitors to Berlin to Hitler's foreign minister Ribbentrop. During the war, he was involved in developing political intelligence reports for the Foreign Office with a particular concentration on American ethnic groups from East Europe. In the 1950s, Sallet was Globke's and Galen's man in the American right. He managed to get Becker's articles demanding an economic blockade of the USSR and the end to all diplomatic contacts with communist governments into the congressional record. He also gathered letters and telegrams supporting such policies from far-right retired generals like Pedro del Valle, Admiral Albert Wiedemeyer, and Charles Willoughby. By the way, I would note all of those associated with the MacArthur Group that we've spoken about before. Continuing. Sallet and Becker especially hated the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD, whose political ally in America was centered in the anti-communist wing of the American trade movement represented by Reuther's UAW and the AFL-CIO's international department headed by Jay Lovestone. Sallet's operation is reflected in the writings of John Birch Society leader Revelo P. Oliver. In part two of his article on the Kennedy assassination, Marksmanship in Dallas, that's Marx as in Karl Marx, for the March 1964 issue of American Opinion, Oliver mentions the existence of, quote, an experienced and highly qualified anti-communist organization which has probably penetrated as far into the Kremlin and its secrets as any human beings, unquote. He recommends a report from the group that a member of the House named Timothy Sheehan inserted into the congressional record on August 5, 1957. This insert turns out to be a report from Becker's Sudeten German National Expelle Association, which served as a cover for the Galen organization since the Expelle Association didn't run operations into the Kremlin. And bearing in mind all of these things, including the domestic Galen networks and their contacts with the American far right, Kevin Coogan then focuses on General Walker's aide, Robert Suri, who later hooked up with George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party. This section is called The Strange Case of Robert Suri. Speaking of General Walker, General Walker's business partner and close aide Robert Suri, whose wife was Walker's personal secretary, enters into both the Kennedy assassination and the attempt on General Walker in two strange ways. It was Suri who produced an infamous leaflet attacking Kennedy called Wanted for Treason, which circulated through Dallas a few days before the assassination. Suri knew about producing leaflets since he worked as a printing salesman for Johnson Printing Company in Dallas. He wrote the leaflet's text and set the type and print at Johnson Printing Company. He then had a salesman named Robert Kraus print about 5,000 copies of the diatribe at a company called Letterhead Printing Company. By the way, I would note that he was assisted in this leaflet by the Conservatism USA or CUSA organization of Larry Schmidt that discussed in RFA programs 11 and 37. Continuing. When Suri was asked about all this during his testimony before the Warren Commission, he surprised the panel by taking the Fifth Amendment, although investigators for the commission knew all the details concerning the leaflet's production. Commissioner Hale Boggs noted that Suri was, quote, the only witness out of hundreds who has pled the Fifth Amendment, unquote. But why did Suri feel he had to take the Fifth when the leaflet was discussed? Suri did, however, discuss his relationship with General Walker. He first met Walker in 1962 when he volunteered to help the general in his failed bid to become Texas governor. He also accompanied Walker to Oxford, Mississippi in September of 1962 during James Meredith's enrollment in the University of Mississippi. While at Oxford, Walker was arrested by the military on October 1, 1962, and charged with inciting to riot, sedition, and other crimes. He spent 4 months in a mental hospital at the instigation of a government psychiatrist before being released by a federal grand jury that refused to indict him. After the Texas election, Surrey and Walker formed their own business called the American Eagle Publishing Company, which issued a series of pamphlets. Surrey was the unpaid president of Eagle Publishing, while Walker, his only partner, put up the money for the operation. Surrey's other contribution to the Oswald affair came as a witness. According to Surrey, on the night of April 8, 1963, while driving past Walker's house, quote, "I saw two men around the house peeking in windows and so forth, and reported this to the general the following morning," unquote. Walker, in turn, notified the Dallas police the next day, a Tuesday. That Wednesday, someone fired a shot into Walker's house. Some 15 minutes after the shooting, Walker called Surrey and told him about the attack. By the way, that attack has been blamed on Oswald. Continuing, Surrey's testimony has always held considerable weight with Warren Commission critics, since he says he observed two men, not one, lurking outside Walker's residence. Yet how could there be two men outside Walker's house if Oswald was the lone nut the Warren Commission said he was? With that fact duly noted, it does seem remarkable that just 2 days after Surrey's sighting, an attempt was made on Walker's life. Surrey was surely questioned by the Dallas police after the attack on Walker. Did the police discuss possible suspects with him? Did they show him mugshots of potential leftist troublemakers like Oswald? Could Surrey, acting either on his own knowledge or from his police sources, have been Deutsche National Zeitung's source for the allegation that Oswald fired on Walker if the paper did indeed print the news well before the rest of the media? This possibility becomes particularly important to investigators, since it turns out that Surrey was himself an avowed Nazi. Even more astonishing, he became a leading sponsor of George Lincoln Rockwell in 1964. Bear in mind Rockwell's connections to both Guy Bannister and Lee Harvey Oswald. And this next section is called Codenamed Mox Ammon. In the spring 1995 edition of The Historian, Frederick Simonelli, who is now finishing the first biography of George Lincoln Rockwell, reports that Rockwell's last major patron was Robert Surrey. Surrey was such a Nazi that he took as his codename Mox Ammon. The real Mox Ammon had been a sergeant in the headquarters company of Hitler's regiment during World War I. In 1921, Hitler brought him into the Nazi party, where he became the party's business manager. Ammon became the director of the Nazis' publishing house, which may be why his name appealed to Surrey. Simonelli also reports that Surrey's wife was Walker's personal secretary. When the general declined to join Surrey's embrace of Rockwell, Mrs. Surrey refused to work for him anymore. But how could Robert Surrey become Rockwell's last major patron when he was himself poor? Although he said he held some shares of the Johnson Printing Company, he was just a salesman there. Nor did he have any money to invest in the American Eagle Publishing Company, as did Walker. Finally, when Surrey was asked at the Warren Commission hearings why he was appearing without a lawyer, he replied, quote, "I cannot afford to bring counsel," unquote. So how could Surrey, who testified before the Warren Commission on June 16, 1964, then become Rockwell's patron? One logical answer would be that Surrey was fronting for other behind-the-scene players. But if so, who were they? And for that matter, when did Surrey become a Nazi? Was it in 1964? Or had he Nazi affiliations dating back even earlier? Without examining this question closely, it is impossible to be fully confident of Surrey's actions during 1963. Finally, it should be noted that Walker and possibly for a time Surrey had been involved in publishing the American Mercury out of Dallas. The American Mercury, once H.L. Mencken's journal, was run for some years by a New York-based writer named Russell McGuire. After his death, Walker became the Mercury's publisher and editor from December 1964 to September 1965, when it was taken over by the American rightist publisher Willis Carto. By examining the story of Guy Bannister, the DMZ, General Walker, and Robert Surrey, I have tried to suggest areas for further inquiry. I do so without having any overall theory about the death of John F. Kennedy or Oswald's role. Nor do I want to suggest that the right or the Nazis killed Kennedy. And I would add that there are some interesting indications that both of those were the case, that Nazi elements did kill Kennedy. I have included that, though, because I do think it raises the relationships that Coogan has described in most in an excellent fashion, do indeed raise some interesting questions. Now, note the ad that was printed in the Dallas Morning News the morning of Kennedy's assassination, accusing him of treason. As discussed in, among other programs, RFAs 11 and 37, and also For the Record segment 120, the organization behind that was the CUSA organization of Larry Schmidt, who, along with his brother Bob, moved directly to Dallas, Texas from Munich, Germany, where he had served in the Army and was recruiting people for his CUSA organization out of Germany. We're going to talk about the CUSA organization and Larry Schmidt. Please note that Larry Schmidt was brought into the company of General Walker, where he may have helped to set up the shooting attempt at Walker, blamed on Oswald, by the aforementioned Robert Suri. We're going to take a look now at the aforementioned landmark text, The Man Who Knew Too Much, authored by Dick Russell, published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff and copyright 1999. Of the relationship between Robert Suri and Walker and the Schmidt brothers, Dick Russell writes as follows. Walker could not remember just when he took Bob Schmidt onto his personal staff, but it was probably before he hit the road with preacher Billy James Hargis early in 1963. It was Walker's aide-de-camp, Robert Suri, who first brought the Schmidt brothers around. So please note that. And of the Schmidt brothers and their political orientation, immediately after Walker departed Munich, Schmidt began quietly organizing his CUSA crusade within the U.S. military there. Schmidt, whose admitted hero was Hitler's propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, had apparently scored an organizing coup d'etat. Recall that in some of our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, we took a look at Professor Stauffer's contention that for years the Underground Reich had been recruiting a fifth column from within U.S. military personnel and their dependents stationed in Germany. That's discussed in For the Record segment 120, and it's against the background of that I see the Schmidt CUSA organization and perhaps the Galen co-option of domestic Gladio networks, which is what I suspect happened to engender the relationships described in Coogan's paper. More from the man who knew too much about Schmidt and CUSA. Schmidt had served two army tours of duty in West Germany, and though he was not a native Texan, came to Dallas straight from Munich after receiving his discharge. He had already mapped out plans in West Germany for an organization called CUSA, Code for Conservatism USA. By June of 1962, Schmidt had signed up several zealots in West Germany inside the military police and the counterintelligence corps. As Look magazine later described it, Schmidt, quote, had trained a small, disciplined band of soldier conspirators to follow him stateside and do, he hoped, whatever is necessary to accomplish our goal. That goal was to infiltrate right-wing groups across the United States and weld them into CUSA with the grand design of taking control of American politics. Schmidt's plan was to gain financial support from wealthy supporters such as Dallas's H.L. Hunt family. By the way, he was successful in that context, as we've seen in previous discussions about CUSA and H.L. Hunt. A Hunt aide named Bradford J. Angers, a former Army security agent and private investigator, maintained that the Schmidt brothers were involved in the organization of the attempt on Walker's life. And Dick Russell describes this and some of the connections of the Schmidts as follows. Angers' story has never before been made public. The young man he is describing could only be Larry Schmidt. This would mean that Schmidt, who was in touch with Charles Willoughby and the Hunt family, would have been perfectly positioned to pass the word along about Oswald. Schmidt and or his brother might even have been acting under instructions in the first place to involve Oswald in the Walker incident. If this account is true, and Angers is sure it is, the implications
are staggering. By the way, I would note that Charles Willoughby, nay Carl Adolf von Chepe und Wiedenbach, was a German-born fascist and was Douglas MacArthur's G2, his chief of military intelligence from 1939 to 1950. Willoughby's described at considerable length in, among other programs, RFA's 10, also RFA 11, and RFA 37. And he's also discussed in the aforementioned For the Record segments 120. So note again that it was Robert Suri, closely associated with George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose name and address and phone number were in Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest, who was also, by the way, associated, Rockwell that is, closely associated with Guy Bannister's detective service. One of Bannister's employees, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, was allegedly the counsel for George Lincoln Rockwell. I would note that Rockwell himself was assassinated in 1967, right about the time that the Garrison investigation was gathering momentum. And again, it was Robert Suri who first brought the Schmidt brothers with their Nazi political antecedents to General Walker and involved them with General Walker's operation. And bear in mind that, again, Schmidt's political role model was Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, and that he was recruiting from his organization from inside the U.S. Army, and I think that should be seen against the background of the 1958 NSC directive that Coogan describes, and also Coogan's hypothetical domestic Gladio network, something that I think existed. Again, I think that in the not only with Kennedy's moves to end the Cold War, normalize relations with Cuba, but in particular in the late 60s with the anti-Vietnam War movement, with the failure of the U.S. military effort in Vietnam, with the rioting that took place in American cities, with the more militant elements of the Black Power movement, and with American radicals creating terrorist incidents, along with no doubt plenty of agent provocateur in that context, I suspect that these domestic Gladio networks were utilized for a variety of activities, not only America's political assassinations, but a variety of other activities as well, from some of the COINTELPRO operations and Operation Chaos activities, both domestic operations by FBI and CIA against anti-Vietnam War and Black Power movement operatives. I suspect that the domestic Gladio networks were involved with those.
That text, again, is excerpted from the speculative manuscript by Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Postwar Fascist International. That speculative manuscript, not available to the general public, is entitled Domestic Gladio? And that excerpt, in turn, was taken from the One Step Beyond program of December 19th of 1999. The various tapes that I produced over the years are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There is a website in which contains a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire, in addition to being equipped with real audio, so you can hear the For the Record segments going out to the various stations that carry that program on the week that they're going out. That website is spitfirelist.com, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. There's also a list of and description of the programs on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the public affairs, in the transmissions and public affairs section. That concludes this program. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.